The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, April 17th, 2009. This is episode number 173, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk about the opening round of MotoGP 2009. So, really good stuff today. Got a long call with Jules to talk about the race out there in Qatar, which, as you're probably aware, there was some issues going on that initially got rained out. And this is right after Jules says it never rains in Qatar, but it rained out the race. It affected the 125 race. It affected the 250 race a bit. The MotoGP race was delayed until the following day. It's kind of a big mess, but whatever. We ended up finally being able to watch a race. Speed TV did broadcast the actual 2009 race on Tuesday, because on the normal slot that they had planned for it on Sunday, they put the 2008 race and had a little scroll across there about it's been delayed. But they did broadcast it again on Tuesday, so at least Speed TV did that. And hopefully you guys had your DVRs set up and everything. And if not, I encourage you to go to MotoGP.com, check it out. Although, as we're going to talk about here in the call with Jules, I can't say it was the most exciting race that I've seen in my life. But, hey, it's MotoGP. It's back. So we're going to be here for the rest of the season. Going to be good stuff. Before we get to the call with Jules, we have, I want to send a big shout-out thank you to a couple of guys, Jonathan Margulies and Jason Farley. We're both kind enough to donate to the cause of MotoGPOD, helping with the Skype bills and the bandwidth and the beer and everything else that goes into making a podcast. And other than that, I had some emails and stuff. Really appreciate the emails from all you guys out there after my little sort of mea culpa, I'm disengaging rant that I had last week. Which one of the things that I've been suspecting for a while here is that when the season ramps up, I'll be more interested in the show. And I think that's already true, but, you know, we'll just sort of see. And like I said in the thing, it is what it is. I'm going to try to sort of stay involved as I can, but unfortunately I just don't have as much time as the show really could use. And it's just difficult. So enough of that. Before we get to our call with Jules, Jules sat down and had a chat, and it's about 15 minutes long or so. He had a chat with Scott Jones, who is a friend of MotoGPOD. We've known Scott for quite a while. He's an avid photographer, super nice guy. Works with David Emmett quite a bit at the MotoGPMatters.com blog. So if you haven't seen of Scott's photos and things like that, you need to check it out. Scott was lucky enough to go to Qatar, which with the way the weather was, maybe lucky is not exactly the right word. But Jules had a little chat with him about going to Qatar and all of that. So we're going to have that before we have the call, and then we're going to jump right into the call with Jules. It's a really long show again, as usual. Shocker. So why don't we just go ahead and get on with it?
Okay, we are at my house in the backyard, and with me is Scott Jones, photographer for MotoGP Matters, and he had just gotten back from Qatar. Say hi.
Hello, everybody.
Well, first of all, how was it out in the desert?
It was awesome. If you have the means to go to the Grand Prix at Qatar, I highly, highly recommend it. The racing at night is awesome to see in person. Doha is a very interesting place to visit, and it's far, so it takes a lot of effort to get there, but I found that it was really, really worth it.
In the back you hear Charlie, that's Scott's dog, getting all excited. So you were there, you got there, you said Sunday before the race, right?
I left on Sunday and got there on Monday, so I had a couple of days to explore Doha a little bit before I actually went out to the track to get my credential and shoot the presentation of the 2009 bikes. They were rolled out in turn by the various teams so that they could be photographed in this year's liveries.
And what kind of access did you get to the track?
I had the sort of standard media pass, the blue card rather than the orange card, so I could go to the media center to set up my computer and my gear, and then had track access, but I didn't have the orange card and the vest. I was not allowed on pit lane or on the grid.
Well, you definitely had some great locations because I saw some of your shots that David posted on the site, and they're just amazing. What were you shooting with? Were you shooting with anything bigger than the 300 this time?
Yeah, I rented a 400 f/2.8.
Oh my God. that's a monstrous lens.
Yeah, my back is still sore from lugging that thing around, but I had gone to Daytona for the AMA opener as a kind of practice for shooting at night, and one of the things that I learned from that trip was that I definitely wanted a faster, long lens, and that was the best that I could come up with.
Nice. Tell me about the actual racing that you saw. I mean, because you were saying that, and I know this from my own experience, that you don't really get to see the results or anything like that, but it was such an incredibly bizarre weekend.
It was a very bizarre weekend, partially because being there out in the desert under those really bright lights at night is just unique in my experience. I've never been to a race that was that kind of an atmosphere, and then, of course, when you added rain to that combination, it got even weirder.
Did you have like rain gear with you?
I brought some rain gear so that it wouldn't rain. And I was joking with one of the Golden Goose photographers who brought a poncho that we had done our part to ensure that it would be a completely dry weekend, but we needed some more of the photographers to bring their rain stuff. So I just had my regular North Face rain jacket that has a little hood, and then I brought, to protect the big lens, I brought a Think Tank cover that goes over the camera and has little slots for your arms to go in so that you can actually shoot in the rain.
Right.
But when it started raining on the 125s, there were a couple of drops, and then it was like someone flipped a switch, and it really started raining hard. So I didn't even take any shots. We just all ran to cover under one of the Dorn had set up for the TV cameras, these kind of wooden platforms that had a kind of a roof, I think, which was mainly for shade because it was just like 2x6s cut off into 6 or 8 foot lengths that are held together with clamps. So the TV cameraman was kind of draped a cover over his camera and was huddled, and then it gave a little bit of a cover. So a bunch of us photographers had a nice little bonding moment there as we were trying to keep dry under that little makeshift shelter.
Now because this is a very unique race in a lot of ways, like the fan turnout is not nearly as big as like Laguna, for example, and does that mean that you get to have more access to like the teams and the riders?
That's definitely one of the unique aspects of this race, in a couple ways. The grandstand holds 2,000 people, and I think the attendance for Sunday was 6,500.
Mm.
And it's separated from the interior of the track. You know, most tracks, there's a tunnel or a bridge or some way to get from the interior to the exterior. But I actually had some people that I'd met in Doha that had come out to the race because I talked about it, and I had no way to get out there to say hi to them. I could just stand in the media center and wave to them because you can, from the stands, you can look across the track into the media center. So a couple times I was on the phone with people that I had just met the day before, waving to them and explaining that there was no way for me to get over there or vice versa to meet face to face. On the other side of the pit lane, there's the garages with the pit lane in front of it, obviously, and then above that is all the TV broadcasting, the media center, and the VIP suites. And behind that, the back of the garages open up to the paddock area. And in sharp contrast to Laguna Seca, where you've got everyone with a paddock pass just gets jammed in behind the garages and has to be kept back with barriers and security guards and stuff. In Qatar, it's just kind of like it was just completely different. The riders were just walking along. Team members were walking around unaccompanied by handlers or any kind of protection. You can go up and talk to pretty much anybody you want to.
Cool.
And the atmosphere was just much different. It was kind of like just being, because you were there, you were like on the inside of the club, you were like on the, you know, on the team. Much different from what you usually find with the, all the people who are in have to be protected from, you know, the fans who come in.
I want to ask you some questions about just night shooting. Like you got you have this incredible photo of Valentino Rossi on the brakes with the little heat
yeah,
trail.
Line, right?
Anything else that you saw that was different because of that night thing? Like there was also a shot you took where there were some amazing sparks flying.
Yeah, a couple people seemed to. Well, I don't know that the. The first one I think you're talking of is Mika Kallio going through,
yes.
And I think that was his foot
in the
peg.
Rear.
That was sparking. But I have this theory that Mattia Pacini, who produced more sparks when he was leaned over than anyone else by a grand scale,
really?
Actually put some kind of abrasive thing in his knee slider because he was making huge sparks when he'd go over. Whenever his knee slider would touch the ground, at one point I was can't remember what turn it was, but he would start making. Sparks.
This is during the race?
Every session
okay.
that he was out there. So I think he's a bit of a publicity hound, and I think he conspired to do that. no one else was getting sparks like that from knee slider. I think other people were throwing up sparks now and then, I think just kind of on accident when something metal on the bike touched the pavement. But he was like a fireworks show.
Right, nice. The main thing I wanted to ask you, which is... a couple years ago, and right on two, we were talking about where did the riders look. Remember this conversation we had? And we were thinking, like, we never really know where Rossi's looking because he's always got the really dark visor.
Right.
And we were talking about, like, well, how can we get through, you know, to see the visor? What's going on behind the visor? Did you get to see it?
Yeah. Actually, this time Rossi had... It was slightly tinted,
mm-hmm.
but you could still see his face. I have some pictures of where you can see. And he... looks pretty much right at the turn where he's going. Other riders, there's a wide variety of where they're looking. I've got some pictures of Colin Edwards, Marco Simoncelli looking right at me mm-hmm. when they're going through the turn. So there's a pretty wide a wide preference for whether they look right where they're going, or if they're looking through the turn, where at the exit of the turn, or far up the track, or perpendicular to where they're going. With a clear visor, you really get a sense of how personal a thing that is, rider to rider.
Yeah, because I know Colin definitely looks very far through the corner. So what's up with Rossi? Is he looking down?
He's looking right where he's going. I think he's looking like, just 10 feet in front of the
really?
In front of the bike.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally we got that mystery solved. That's awesome. Gibbernau was back.
Yeah.
Did you get to see him in the paddock?
Yeah, he was walking around.
Yeah. He's very reclusive. Like at Laguna Seca, I remember he just would run through and didn't want to say hello or anything.
I think that he'd probably, I expect he'll be like that at Laguna Seca again, but
yeah.
this was such a unique environment there that he was cruising around. I mean, you saw, the only one who wasn't really standing around just being part of the group was Rossi. Even Stoner, who... definitely usually keeps some separation between himself and the rest of the world. He was out. I talked to him. He wouldn't do an interview for MotoGP Matters, but I did.
That's right. You did a couple of... You talked to Marco Melandri.
Yeah.
Who else did you get to talk to?
I talked to... the first one that I did was with Guy Coulon.
Oh, right. Right.
I had a kind of a happy coincidence that I was staying at the same hotel as the whole Tech 3 team.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turned out that Colin Edwards was staying right across the hall in the room directly opposite of me. So I talked to him several times. Very
cool.
Laid back, relaxed guy. He was a lot more relaxed than I was. which I found kind of ironic.
What was the biggest surprise about Qatar for you? Like, both in terms of the place and the racing. Well, obviously, you know, there was a big surprise of you not seeing the race on Sunday and having to wait till Monday to do it.
The biggest surprise for me, I think, was just how interesting Doha was, because I had talked to several people before I went who had been there, other journalists who'd gone, and they said that Doha was just uninteresting and sucked, basically, and you would go in and do your job and get out as fast as you can. And my wife had booked my flight for me and had given me several days to explore a little bit, and I thought after talking to these people that was going to be a waste of time. I was going to be sitting in the hotel watching CNN the whole time. And that was definitely not true for me. I thought Doha was really interesting. Met several people, as I mentioned, who ended up coming to the race. The city is very interesting because there's so much money there, and it's basically right now a giant construction area. Like, if you can imagine building San Francisco from the ground up, just starting with a flat piece of desert, and you're going to build San Francisco as it is now, but you're going to do it in 2 or 3 years. That's kind of how Doha is now. Across the bay from where I was staying, there are these fantastic skyscrapers of very original and unusual designs going up. The construction crews are going almost around the clock. At 2 a.m. I get back from the track, and you can still hear the construction going on over there. The Qataris want it done, and they want it done right now. And at the same time, it's a very old city, so there's the, you know, I was staying, my hotel was kind of in the working class section of the town, the older section, and there are all these mosques around. So one thing that I got to experience that the people at the fancy hotels didn't was the morning call to prayer at 4:30.
Oh, wow, excellent.
Just kind of out of the silence, you'd hear
the vocalizations. The term
for, they'd come over the loudspeaker, and they had this whole kind of battle of the bands thing going, trying to be more, you know, come to my mosque. So it was really interesting to experience that every morning at 4:30 after getting back from the track at 2. And it would come right through the earplugs. So I finally got, after talking to, I asked Colin Edwards how he dealt with that. He said, oh, just wait till they're done, and I go to bed after. So I thought, I should start doing that. So the last several days over there, I would just stay up and wait for that to finish and then go to sleep after that, because the next one wasn't until 11.
Cool. All right, well, thanks for talking to us. When are your pictures coming up?
Well, some of them are already up on through MotoGP Matters, and I just got back last night, so I've got all the race photos from the race itself.
Excellent.
To go through, and I'll be putting more of those up on MotoGP Matters, and then put a collection up on my MotoGP gallery on my website, which is Turn 2 Photography, turn with the numeral 2, photography.com.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that. Thank you very much, and welcome back.
Thanks a lot.
All right, cool.
All right, we got Jules on the phone today. How are you doing tonight, Jules?
Not too bad. How are you?
I am excellent. We had a somewhat super exciting start to the MotoGP season.
Yeah, there was definitely excitement there.
There was a lot of excitement for me on like Saturday evening, Sunday morning, and then things tapered off a bit.
Yeah, for us it was kind of a bummer because we actually had a huge house full of people that were, we got the computer hooked up to the TV, this, you know, the big speakers, and the living room was filled with people, and everybody was waiting for the race to start, and for the GP race to start. At least we got to watch the 250s, which was a fantastic race.
It was a great race. The, I have not yet watched the 125s, which is a 4-lap sprint, but the 250s
that would take
was
like
a
5 minutes.
Race.
What? The, what?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I haven't found the time to watch that 5-minute race. real quick, I want to ask you a question. But real quick, the Sunday MotoGP race, if you haven't been following it and everything, was canceled by rain. Which, if I recall, Jules, you said it never rains in Qatar, and this was a torrential downpour, and it got delayed 24 hours is what ended up happening. But your experience there with a room full of people was duplicated by at least a couple of listeners that we got emails from.
Right.
And it was kind of weird. It's, you know, it was 1 o'clock my time here, and I've been doing the sort of Sunday morning thing, sitting around and everything. I think I had a little nap, and then, you know, I did the same thing, plug in the TV and all of that and get ready to go. I'm going to watch MotoGP. This is awesome. And I rain.
So, you know, and I actually was did a bunch of research on Sunday evening trying to find out when was the last time that a race, that the premier race class was GP race was actually canceled for reasons other than like the first lap there was a fatal accident, like, you know, with
2002 or
well, no,
that, yeah,
they didn't stop the race during when Kato was killed because they thought he was, I mean, nobody knew that he was actually in, and you know, he didn't pass away right away. No, I was right. Thinking like back in the 70s, you know, and the horrible one where we lost
with Yarno.
Yeah.
And but it's been a long time since this happened.
Yes, so and for it to happen in Qatar is just like bizarre. But a friend of mine actually pointed out, she's been there a few times, and she pointed out that it's actually really humid in Qatar during the summer, and especially because they're not that far from the ocean in Doha, and that racetrack is not that far from the ocean, or well, not the ocean, but the Gulf,
right?
And it says it's just that it's so hot that the water's stays in the air, and you know, so the fact that it's at night means that if you get your dew point, you know, too low or too high, whatever, too
right.
high, then you're gonna just get a downpour. I mean, basically, I think what happened was that the water was literally creating, like, probably being created, like, not that far above their heads, just and coming out of the air because
yeah,
it was humid.
This early in the year and everything. I mean, Qatar and well, Qatar is a fair amount south of Kuwait, but the weather changes in 100 miles there.
Right,
it's completely different. And judging just from Iraq, going from Kuwait to Iraq, you know, everybody talks about Iraq being full of sand. It's not really sand; it's dust. It's totally different. And it gets damn cold in the wintertime, and it was still cold in March.
Yeah,
you know,
so,
starting to warm up in the daytime and everything. So, you know, Qatar is a somewhat similar thing. Everybody thinks, oh, it's baking hot all the time, but it's not. And actually, Dorna and everybody said, you know, well, after last year, maybe we should move this race a little later in the season if we're going to do it at night. But the Qataris wanted to be the first race out of the gate.
Yeah, and I'm sure they're paying quite a bit for it, because it's if you think about it, look at all the things that this round causes.
Oh,
like,
God.
The entire season is compressed because it's a month later, right?
Yeah,
because it still ends in October, and this night thing it hasn't worked out, because
no.
Last year they had. It was way colder than anybody expected.
Right, and the track was wet, actually. Literally, the ground was wet.
Right.
Dewy.
And,
yeah.
You know, that should have been kind of like a
big wake-up call?
Like an omen for what this year, you know? I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
That I mean, if they had held it during the day, it would have been fine. And I think a lot of riders are getting a little bit fed up with the whole light thing, and it's a waste of.
I think so.
It's. I mean, it does look cool,
but let's do it later in the year. If you're going to do that, I mean, the temperature drops radically at night. Although that close to the ocean and everything, your temperature differential is not quite the same as it might be in the absolute middle of the desert.
Yeah,
but it's cooled off enough, and you don't have the sun just cooking that asphalt. And all of that. So you could hold this race in like June, or, you know, and probably would work out much better.
Yeah, and I just feel terrible for, like, the, you know, Australian fans who, like, went out there.
Yeah.
They were one of the, you know, 5,000 fans or whatever they had, some ridiculous low number.
Which, for Qatar, though, a fair
number.
It's
not
bad.
Actually, the numbers are good for Qatar, yeah. But I just feel bad for the people who, like, booked tickets the next day to leave. Hopefully not too many people did that. Hopefully people, you know, were sticking around. But
Scott Jones, you talked to him.
Yeah.
So, which I haven't even heard that call yet, so I'm just throwing it out there. But, yeah, he went to Qatar.
Right, he went to Qatar, and he did get to see the race, but he had to we didn't cover this in the interview, but we talked about it over lunch, and he basically had to skip the last two laps of the race, and he had to race to the airport to get his plane.
Oh, man. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of airports, on Sunday, when they were still dicking around of, like, are we going to race? This torrential downpour. If I had to hear Nick Harris say one more time that, does anybody have the phone number for Qatari Airlines? I think I was going to kill myself. It was awful.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. It was, the whole thing was a bit of a mishmash where they just didn't, you know, there was this glimmer of hope, I guess, that they thought that all of a sudden the skies would turn off and the track would magically dry.
Well, because it did it after the 125s. I mean, that was
the
same kind of downpour.
It was different.
The downpour was the same. It just that it didn't last nearly as long. I mean, after 15 minutes, it was gone, and then the track started drying out. And by the time the 250s came out, and the race was short for the 250s because of all the time constraints, and they wanted to wait until it dried out.
I don't think these people know enough about rain. I mean, and especially half of them come from England. You know, maybe they ought to come to Oregon a little bit. When it's raining at 11 o'clock at night like that, it doesn't matter if it's raining for 15 right, minutes right. or 45 minutes. I mean, the track's not going to dry out.
Right.
So, I don't know. It was a bit of a mishmash. And I think that they should move it later in the season. But also, on the other hand, though, I'm getting a little bit tired of the layout of the Qatar track. And that it's such a modern, very, very wide track. It's got some interesting bits, but I think that the width of the track seems to be killing some of the racing that might occur otherwise.
Why do you say that? I mean, the width of the track would actually make me think that you'd have more lines.
I know, but it doesn't seem like that. Everybody was following the same line.
Alex DeAngelis and Danny Pedrosa.
No, that's a problem. They tried to follow the exact same line. we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. I digress. I don't know. I've never been 100% convinced that Qatar is a very good place to have a race, and also that this particular track is anything all that super exciting. Cameras and stuff are so far away from this track. It's just...
Yeah, that's true. I will say that in, you know, my only experience with actually the racetrack is, of course, on the console games. And... I actually find that it is an interesting track. It's got some really brutal, very low slow speed corners. But then the last section of the track I think is extremely exciting. All these right handers and then left hand kink, and then back
right.
to the straight. Those right handers are really crucial. And I think that the reason why we had the race that we did was that because everybody was losing time to Casey Stoner in that section. Casey Stoner had that section nailed. Because if you looked at all the times during practice, during qualifying, I3, getting into... So that section is actually starts at the end of I2 and begins with I3. It's definitely where people were losing time to him. Everybody, across the board. Like I was watching for that, and it was definitely like... They looked like they were gonna be close to him, and then I3 came up, and then they would be back five tenths of a second or something like that. So, yeah, I mean Casey Stoner was just on fire and amazing, and his lean angles this weekend were just out of whack. I mean, just unfreaking believable. I don't know if it's just the frame or his confidence is back all the way back up, but he was just lying that thing down.
So can we say safely that our prediction that there was a lot of sandbagging going on was correct?
Yeah, I think so.
I agree. He was out there. He was on form. He ran a perfect, if somewhat boring, race, and it was impressive. I mean, we might as well just go ahead and start, you know, spoiling
yeah,
as far as results. So if you haven't watched the race, you stop. But he got the whole shot. He pulled out.
He set the
right
fastest
away.
Lap on the second lap.
Yeah, yeah, and he pulled out right away a good size gap and just never let it go.
Never.
The closest Rossi got to him was in the 2 second range.
It was 1.988. Actually, yeah. It was a little bit less than that in that same lap. But again, in I3, he lost a bit there. So
right, and you know, he probably looked at his pit board and said, "Okay, you know, dial it in one notch up."
Actually, no, that's not what happened. Actually,
no?
Because in the post race interviews,
mm-hmm. Which I didn't see yet. Yeah.
Oh, so Casey Stoner talks about like, oh yeah, and I had to manage my fuel load, so I kind of like backed it off a little bit. Halfway through the race, and then I realized that I was going to be able to make it, so I was able to manage the fuel. I cranked it back up, you know. Basically, he's trying to play. This is my opinion, but I'll tell you why I believe it's true. He's trying to play a mind game with Rossi here, saying, "Oh, the only reason why I got close is because I was managing my fuel, and then it turned out that you know all my settings looked right, so I flipped the switch and I was gone." Right, which is total BS. Because if you look at his times were almost spot, like lap by lap by lap, exactly the same. 156.2, 156.3, 156.3, 156.2, 56.5, 56.0, 56.4, 56.3, 2, 4, 5. Then he had one slow lap, 56.9, then back to 56.6, 56.5, 56. So bullshit. He was running a typical stoner, I'm very comfortable, but pushing it to the limit, to his limits, race. And it was Rossi who, and I was saying this during the race to my wife, I was saying, he gave up on catching Stoner. Around what lap was that? I think it was probably around lap 17 or something like that.
So yeah, fairly late in the race, yeah. 3/4 of the way.
Well, he realized, okay, there's I'm making up a tenth here, a tenth there, and did some calculations in his head and was like, you know, those 20 points, they sound pretty good right now. And sure enough, during the interview, that's what he said. That's what Rossi said. Rossi said, yeah, you know, the 20 points was more important than trying to catch Casey, who
right,
was really just.
Right. Because he'll make it up at Jerez.
Maybe, yeah.
Possibly Motegi.
Yep.
I mean,
maybe,
you know.
Maybe. Motegi's, you know.
Motegi's been more of a question mark than Jerez, but let's face facts. I mean.
Sure.
That's Casey's bugaboo.
It is. But except, yeah, you know, he did well in testing there this year, so.
Yeah. Testing is testing.
Yeah, yeah.
In effect, though, halfway through the race, because I had picked Rossi to win this one, I thought that he would come out of the gate for the season, and you know, maybe I was fooled a little bit by the sandbagging and this and that and just the Rossi mystique, whatever it was. I don't know. I figured Rossi was going to win this one. And halfway through the race, he had about ballparky a 2 second odd gap. And I'm like, well, Rossi can pick that up in 10 laps, you know?
Right.
But it wasn't to be.
Not
I mean,
against Stoner.
No, it just never got any better than that. And I think that whatever it was, and eventually Rossi did put it on cruise control into maintenance mode, and he ended up finishing 7.75 seconds back.
Yep.
It's just, you know, he wasn't making it up. The gaps, it was such a small amount that he would, you know, every now and then he'd run a lap that was, you know, like 0.2 seconds faster than Stoner or something like that. And it's like, well, that's not enough. You
well,
know,
he was definitely, he was doing it for a long time, but I think he basically, it was too little to get into the end of 22 laps and actually catch Stoner and
right.
then still have
right.
to pass him too.
Right, and so. Now part of that also, though, was that Rossi didn't get a very fabulous start. He was actually down into fourth place on the first lap.
Yeah.
I think
he was in third,
standings,
but yeah, you're right.
On the official standings, but actually in the race, he was
yep.
in fourth. He
exactly.
just picked that place up.
Yep.
And he was held up a little bit And was that enough to screw things up? I don't know.
You could say that he was held up, but he was quite a... Right. I mean, Caparossi had a fantastic pace. And I think Rossi did lose some time having to pass Caparossi, but...
Did he lose that much time?
You know what?
No.
I still, even if Rossi had gotten a better start, and he actually did have a good start. If you look
for
at the,
Rossi, it was an excellent start. If you look at
the video of the very beginning of the race, Rossi has a fantastic start, but he turned in too late. I think he ran it a little bit too deep in that corner, which means a lot of guys got on the inside of him.
Right, because basically turn one he was back in.
He was like fourth or
fifth. P4, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think even if he had got a fantastic start and if he had gotten the whole shot.
It may have been different.
But even picking up second, I don't think he could have. Stoner was too much on the ball on this track. And did you see Toner's tires? The whole
yes.
When they showed the bike's tires?
Yeah.
That was amazing. Everybody's tires looked shag. Rossi's and Lorenzo's tires looked shot.
Right.
And Stoner's looked pretty clean.
Well, they were shagged.
They were still shot, but they were more evenly shot.
Yes,
they, you know
exactly,
what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Didn't look so shagged.
Right, right.
And that was a bit of a surprise because everybody was running the B compound or whatever, the sort of middle of the road.
Yeah.
Because in the 250 race, which we'll want to talk about here in a little bit, they were worried about tire wear. Did everybody go with a softer compound in the 250s?
They did go with a softer compound. Because of the track was cooled by all the rain,
right?
So they did run a softer compound, and because the race was going to be shorter, they ran a softer compound, and they were kind of worried about finishing.
Right, exactly. Because yeah. I remember it was a 13 lap race in the in the 250s, and they were saying that the tires were going to last, you know, like
12 or 11 or something
11
like that.
Laps or yeah, something yeah. like that. It's like, oh, great. What are we going to do for the last two laps?
Yeah.
But we'll get to the 250s in a minute. It was fun because it's the first race, and I've been waiting a long time to see MotoGP, and I was really disappointed on Sunday when, you know, I had the same thing that you did. I had the TV set up. I was going to watch it live 1 p.m., and I had done some fiddling, which maybe we should get to in a technical call about how hooking up your computer to the TV, what's the best way, and all of that. But in a nutshell, you know, after, you know, 10 minutes of fiddling around, I had the race filling my screen. TV, and I was sitting there watching the rain.
Right,
it's
right.
Like, you know, because I didn't come in for the 250s. I only came in for the MotoGP race, and I was a little disappointed. But I ended up watching the rerun on Monday night of the race, which I ran, you know, on my computer. And I don't even know this, if Speed, when they did the replay on Tuesday, I haven't even looked yet. Did Speed show, because what they showed on Sunday was the 2008 race. Did they show the 2009 race on Tuesday, or did they rerun the 2008 race? Do you know that yet?
I have no idea. I don't even watch Speed.
You don't even bother with it anymore? Yeah,
no,
yeah.
No,
I should have checked before the show, because I don't know either. Because that would be extremely lame if they did, and that's, I'll cover that in the intro. But to I wanted to watch the race and all of that. So I ended up watching it Monday because it occurred, 11 o'clock in the morning, our time, Pacific mm-hmm. time. And so, you know, came home from work and everything and pulled it up on the internet. And that's one thing about MotoGP.com. We have found a link that you can get to where you can watch the most recent race. And as long as you're sort of careful, you won't spoil it for yourself. And I managed to do that. I had no idea the results. Watched the race, and it was like I said, it wasn't the greatest race in the world. What's that?
You gonna post that link?
I will. I will post that link. I'll put a note to myself. It's most recent race or what link or whatever it is, and you go straight to the page. Like I said, you're sort of holding your hand over some of the, you know,
ticker tape
areas
and all
of the
stuff.
Webpage,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
As long as you do that, you should be good to go.
Cool.
And,
that's great.
Yeah,
that's great to know.
It worked out great. Like I said, I've only got I don't have the high res package. I have the standard res package.
Yeah, that actually looked pretty good on the big TV. I mean,
it looked great on the big TV. Yeah, I really, it was a satisfying experience for what it was. I'm looking forward to Motegi to have a more satisfying experience.
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I'm really glad that Motegi is on a different schedule than Asin in World Superbikes, because otherwise I'm not sure which one I'd rather watch live.
Yeah, I know. From a racing standpoint, you know, you're just looking at motorcycle racing. Exactly. I'd probably have to go with World Supers, to be honest with you. From a being a MotoGP snob standpoint, mm-hmm. it's MotoGP all the way. You know, yeah. I will continue to hold out that MotoGP holds the best, most satisfying racing action. But we've talked about this one before. It's just because I sort of feel like I know these guys in MotoGP better than I know the World Superbike guys.
Yep. Yep.
So real quick, let's maybe run down the results of MotoGP and some comments and stuff, because we got to talk about Danny's incident. I think that was probably the most significant thing that happened at Qatar. On the podium, though, we had Casey Stoner with a runaway win, Valentino Rossi with a mostly runaway second spot after lap, four or so, and Jorge Lorenzo on third. And as far as where they qualified, let's see, it was Stoner, Rossi, Lorenzo. Yeah.
Lorenzo was quite a ways back for a while. If it wasn't for Rossi...
He did. He was always down in like sixth or something like that, I think.
I'm saying he was down time-wise on Rossi. He was down like, you know, 12, 13 seconds at one point. So once again, the two greatest riders, I think, in the class really just were outclassing everybody else. Everybody else was just, you know, okay, let's fight for third, fourth, and so on. And there was a great fight for third.
There were several good battles. We had some passing. They didn't seem to show a lot of it on the broadcast of the actual pass. It was a little bit like we came back to it.
Right.
But there was some good battles going on. Colin Edwards, Lorenzo, like I said, he was down the order there for a little bit.
He was, I think he was like fourth, fifth. He was fighting with Caparossi, Edwards, and Dovizioso.
Yeah.
Those are good things, but you know, Dovizioso kind of really faded, man. His tire situation was really bad. So he actually kind of lucked out finishing in fifth. I think he may have actually gotten caught by a couple of riders.
Do you think it seems like the Hondas, I mean, cause like Pedrosa, started off okay, and faded badly.
Yeah, but he faded badly after the contact.
That's true. The contact. Yeah, because I was leading towards is the Honda and the Bridgestones a good mix?
You know, that's a great question. I think we won't really have an answer for a couple more races to see, because Qatar is a tire eater. Right. So, you know,
and a bit of an anomaly there too with Pedrosa's incident, which we got to talk about.
Yeah.
As far as that, but okay, going down the thing. And also, I wanted you picked the top six on the MotoGP.com picking competition.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was looking. I was like, oh my god, I can't believe it. I got all six. I would have had nine if Caparossi hadn't crashed and had finished seventh. Then I would have had the top nine.
I think that's pretty significant. I didn't even bother playing in that game because I pretty much suck at these picking things, which right on two picking, I had Rossi Stoner.
You're in second place, though.
Yeah.
Along with like
I haven't even looked.
200 other people.
How
and
could I
I'm
be
in first,
second place?
I'm in first place with like 261 people, so yeah.
But in any case, and I also picked no riders to DNF.
Obviously nobody picked Caparossi to fall first, because if you look at the points.
Right. And I was so, you know, because so that was funny. A long time into the race that, you know, nobody crashed the first corner and everything. Everybody's cooking along. Marco goes off track. He's trying to move through the gravel, and I'm like, don't crash, and he managed to get back out on track, and you know, sure, for Marco, you know, and now he's 18th, but he was still in the race, so I didn't have a DNF, and then Loris lost it, and it was like, Why did you lose it there, Loris? I mean, it wasn't... what happened there? And I think Loris was a little bit of the same opinion of like, what the hell was that?
I don't know if you can hear it, but the world's smallest violin is playing for you.
So whatever. So I lost my 2 points. Well, who did you pick? What did you pick on the first out of that
I actually race? Picked DeAngelis.
Really?
Yeah. Because... Interesting. Yeah. And then he's kind of a wild rider.
He surprised
you.
Yeah, he's a little wild.
No, I mean, he could definitely finish up there. He's shown that before, but he's also crashed almost as much as LCR.
Right. Win it or Bennett RDP. But not quite winning it. Do well or Bennett kind of guy.
Yeah. So, so then we had Colin Edwards, we had Dovizioso, and we had DeAngelis. And... Really, Dovizioso, he lost his pace like somewhere around lap 15 or 16, and then he kind of regained it. So it's almost like something happened with the tire that he didn't expect, but then he kind of got his rhythm back, you know?
Yeah.
It went off like maybe within one lap, like he started sliding on the right side and all those right corners in the second part of the track. But he recovered because otherwise these guys all had like much better times than him, and he was going to get just trounced by a big mob, you know. Of course, in DeAngelis, let's talk about the DeAngelis Pedrosa thing now, I guess.
Yes, let's.
So I don't even know what lap it was. It was probably around lap 10 or something like that. So Pedrosa was starting to lose a couple of spots here and there, but he wasn't too bad off. He was having a fight with Vermeulen, and yeah. Vermeulen got past him and kind of shoved him a little bit wide, and DeAngelis was, you know, took the opportunity to try and get through, and I mean, just whacked Pedrosa on the side. Pedrosa really got knocked off the bike. Like he was riding side saddle almost. Yeah. And this is the leg that he was operated on that it got hit, you know?
Right, his left leg.
Yep, got back on the bike, recovered, but then after that he started losing time.
He faded fast. Well, now did you...
I wanted to ask you, like, how quickly do you think Puig was on the phone with Espeleta or somebody else, stewards? Because immediately they were like... I mean, like within moments, there was this little ticker tape going on along the bottom, like, oh, incidents being reviewed by the track stewards, and I'm like thinking, you know, Puig was on the phone the moment he saw that.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Riders 3 and 15 will be scrutineered. And I thought immediately my reaction was that it was a no-brainer.
It was a total racing incident. Here's what happened.
Exactly.
Went wide because of the way that Vermeulen passed him, and he made a mistake, really, Pedrosa there. And DeAngelis thought he could make it through, and Danny, I think, tried to close the door on him, to be honest.
And
there was nothing that – I think DeAngelis was basically, looking for a hole, and that disappeared and got filled with Pedrosa. And right. He looked back to make sure that Pedrosa was okay. You could see in the
He definitely looked back. Yeah.
So he I think he recognized that the contact was pretty severe, especially to Pedrosa. So I don't think they ducked. They I don't think anything is going to happen out of it.
I don't think anything went of it. I haven't read any stories about it. Pedrosa's reaction was interesting, which was that, you know, he slams disrespectful DeAngelis after the Qatar collision and all of that, which was kind of interesting because he had he came straight into me. I was in front and he came into me to close me down. He showed no respect, but life will return the favor to him. You know, and this is the quote.
His little puppet mouth is opening
exactly,
and closing.
Exactly. That's the quote machine going on there. I was a little surprised, you know, and I haven't seen the official news of anything that ever came out of that.
Well, I think it takes a little while for that to get reviewed.
Does it that long? I mean, it's been a week. Well,
no, this hasn't several been a week. Days. It's been 2 days.
That's like a week in MotoGP time. But yeah, that one I mean it was significant, and Pedrosa manned up and stayed on that motorcycle.
He really did.
That was a very significant hit, and he did. You know, you can see he was all over that motorcycle. But the I don't think that it was anything much more than a racing incident.
Yep, I agree.
Right, and so that was about the most exciting point of that whole race.
Yeah, I mean, there was some. The Nikki thing was also, I thought, pretty awesome.
Yeah,
Nikki's kind of comeback at the end. Like, all of a sudden, he went, "Oh, I get it." You know, we had Vermeulen, we had Kallio, and we had Elias. I was very impressed with Kallio, actually.
Yeah,
and so was his team. They were saying after the race that he seems to be getting this bike in the same way that Stoner has gotten it, whereas the other riders are still trying to like force it to do things that they're used to on other bikes. So that bodes well for him. You know, Vermeulen had a good ride. The Suzuki, I think if Caparossi had stayed in the race, I think he would have finished. I bet that he was going to finish behind Vermeulen, but thinking about it now, I think that watching his pace at the start, I think he would have finished a little higher up than Vermeulen. You know, and Elias was kind of hot and cold all weekend. He had really terrible times in practice. What was he starting from? What position?
Elias started at 12th. So yeah, he picked up 3 spots.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's something. That's significant.
2 spots because Caparossi crashed, but...
Yeah, that's true. Okay, if you want to put it that way. But, you know, in raw results, 12th to 9th,
yeah.
You know, hey, you improved your grid position.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, I think at least had a good race. The Honda riders are a bit of a mystery to me this year of exactly what's going to be happening.
Big time. Yeah. I mean, throughout testing, Honda was a mid-pack ride.
And, right.
You know?
Exactly. And we've got a fair number of them. They're all talented.
So, it's there was a great article in GP1 that my friend Dario, who's Italian, obviously reads Italian, translated for me, in which Rossi's talking about... he's basically saying that what's wrong with Honda is that they don't have a good rider. So that was one translation that I saw on a forum, and I thought, that seems a little bit extreme. And I asked my friend Dario if he saw the article. He said, no, that's not at all what he said. What he said was they don't have a good development rider right now.
Mm. Right.
Which is I think kind of in a way saying like, you know, yeah, maybe you had one when you had Nicky Hayden, but now you don't. I mean, you've got Dovizioso, who's learning how to ride in MotoGP. You've got Pedrosa, who the bike is being developed for, but not by. And, you know, I mean, the other guys, De Angelis, new guy, René Depounier, you know, I don't think he has any kind of development skills there.
He can develop the crash worthiness of that motorcycle.
Yeah.
René Depounier is the crash test dummy of MotoGP.
and then Takahashi was also a rookie, so you know,
right.
I think, and so he said that if it was him or Stoner on the Honda, then it would be winning championships. But he wasn't saying it as a like in a stuck up way. He was just saying it as a matter of fact way. Like there's riders out there that are really good developer riders, and in the last 2 years, this bike has not gotten better. Because there hasn't been a really good developer rider on them,
and that is so true that there's guys that are worth factories paying their salaries and everything because they can develop a bike.
Yeah,
you know, they may not turn in the best results all the time, but they can come out and tell you what's going on with this motorcycle.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's actually probably a super good point too. I need to read that article. But moving on down.
Push up on your Italian.
Yeah, that's the problem there, yeah. Moving on down, 10th spot, Randy DePunier.
Mm-hmm.
What is up with that?
So, what, that he didn't crash?
Yes, he didn't crash.
Yeah, well, you know, when he doesn't crash, he finishes up in the top ten.
Usually. I'm being kind of cold to Randy because actually he also lost several spots from his grid position because he qualified.
He qualified in the second row,
seventh, third row.
Oh, third row. Okay, that's right. Yeah. He got bounced out just at the last moment. Qualifying actually was very exciting, I thought, because for once you didn't have that go out for three laps and go back in. I mean, some of the riders did that because their settings were screwed up. And they wanted to try something different. But in general, they were staying out for, you know, four or five hot laps, which is, I thought, awesome to see that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. And then that's also something to do with the fact that the qualifying tires are no longer there.
Well, I mean, that is why. That is why.
Exactly. It is the reason why. Because a Q tire, you go out and you do one hot lap and you're done.
Yep.
Whereas with the regular tires, it wasn't quite the same. But we still weren't seeing, even all the way up into qualifying, like you said, like five laps and stuff like that. Nobody was doing big, long, you know, well, they're not going to do a race sim in qualifying. But
they were doing four or five laps sometimes. I mean, that's including the in and out, but still, you know, right. That's pretty decent. And what was really just sick was just, I mean, Stoner was just really sick during qualifying. Like, you know, he set his fast lap, went out and beat it by like a second. Then he, you know, then he went to sit down for half the session while everybody was like, you know,
what the hell?
Bug-eyed and like trying to get close to him. I think then Rossi got really close to him for a brief moment. Stoner came back out and just knocked off another bunch of tenths of seconds. So that was just crazy watching that, and just in general, I thought it was cool watching that session.
It's got to be a little discouraging, even for Rossi.
To
see that.
Yeah,
don't you think? I mean,
I totally think so.
Talking about getting in somebody's head,
it's discouraging to us fans too, because you know if Rossi gets out front, well, anyway, not these days because now he has to get out front and beat guys like Stoner, but a few years ago, when Rossi would get out front, you know, he would pace himself, but he wouldn't just run away with the race because he would pace himself to a degree. I'm not saying he controlled the entertainment value of the race, but the bikes were closer, I think. The racing was closer for many technical reasons. But also, I think, like, the only way that guys like Stoner and DeVizioso, I mean, no, sorry, not DeVizioso, but Pedrosa can win is by doing what those kinds of runaways, which are no fun for the fans.
Right.
And, you know, I'm still amazed by Stoner. I'm getting, you know, with every race and for the last, you know, 20 races, even going back to Qatar in his rookie season, He's just been growing. Respect has been growing, but, you know, it was a boring race.
The thing is that I think, and I'm not sure if this is just a different way that we view people in general, you and I, but I think that Rossi does consider that when he's out there, that Rossi could tick in those faster laps when he's out in front, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he chooses to let the other guy catch up for
many reasons. I think the entertainment value does come into play, but I think also for other reasons, which is like, you know, personal, like adrenaline rush junkie type of thing.
Possibly true. Yeah. Yeah. He's a battler because
I don't know. I mean, the few times that I've actually like been on track days and situations where I was, you know, I met up some guy just before the race and said, hey, you want to do like a couple of laps together? Like, that was so much more fun than circulating by myself, you know?
Right.
And there's motivation. There's different kinds of motivation. I mean, I think it's very motivating to be...
You have somebody to pace yourself against, if nothing else.
Yeah,
exactly. that might be part of it. I don't know. I still think that there's this sort of cynical side of me that Rossi wants to sell T-shirts and hats, and Stoner just wants to win races.
Yeah,
it's like Stoner is like, you know, he's and that's what makes, and we've talked about this one before, that's what makes Stoner a little bit boring. Mm-hmm. Is that he can go out there and he's like clockwork, ticking in these lap times of what wears lap times, you know, just insane, the same, you know, one after the other, you know, maybe a tenth off, which a tenth is big, but it's still, you know, he's just putting in the laps, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I got to finish 22 laps this race and now I'm done, you know. Yeah, whereas Rossi is a little bit more like...
Those laps are 2 seconds faster than most of the field.
Exactly. No, yeah. I'm not slighting Stoner's ability. I'm just I'm saying that he's like, you know, he's gonna finish the race. Whereas Rossi is sort of like, you know, if you want to be really cynical, if you want to be Bob about this, how many T-shirts am I going to sell when I win a race by 7 seconds compared to how many T-shirts am I sell when I win a race by a bike length? You know what I mean?
Sure.
Is that too cynical?
The thing is, we're overanalyzing. Who knows? You know. I just don't want to see this kind of racing anymore.
No, I agree. That's why I'm looking forward to some of the other rounds here, where it's guaranteed to be a little bit closer racing.
Yeah.
So moving on down the order. after Randy DiPugni in 10th, we had Danny Pedrosa in 11th. Pedrosa had an interesting race.
Yeah. Great that he showed up.
It is. He manned up. Because he qualified 14th.
Yeah.
Not very good. And, you know, I think he was affected by his injuries.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. He did quite well. He was up there, and until his incident with DeAngelis, he was doing really well.
I think he was up in sixth place at one point.
After you qualified down, you know, 14th, that's a very significant gain. And you know, it was interesting stuff to watch and to sort of see how he was doing, but again, also though, and this might be a bit of it, because, you know, I don't know how much Pedrosa's knee, you know, did he get whacked, you know, and was the bike, because we saw him slamming it looked like he was slamming his clip on and
Harris. The announcers were talking about the fact that because those levers have a little bend in the center of it
right.
So they could bend out of the way when the bike goes down, because they're very expensive. It looked like maybe he was like it was out of place and he had to
like he was it down. Fixing
or,
it,
or he was just pissed.
That's what I thought. That's what I got out of it. It was slamming in frustration. But you know, on the other hand, the camera angle was a long ways away because the cameras are, you know, 4 miles away from the racing in Qatar, and so you're just not 100% sure what's going on. But it was, and Pedrosa's comments, which I do think were somewhat pooch driven, as far as, you know, his saying that DeAngelis was disrespectful and all of that. I don't know.
I just don't buy that Danny would say such a thing. That's so not. I mean, I don't, well, how much do we know about his personality? Not much, but.
what personality?
That sounds exactly the same that Puig said. Let's just put it that way.
Exactly.
You know, disrespectful. I mean, like I could say like a little wild, or like, you know, he made a mistake, but disrespectful. You know, WTF? Whatever.
Yeah. And that's the thing about Pedrosa, is that you never really know. Well, any of these guys, actually, you read the press releases and it's like, I don't think Rossi said that.
Yeah.
You know, it's somebody is saying that for them.
Sure.
And that's the problem, that when we read, when the news that we get is all entirely press releases, it's a little bit like, well, we you have to filter it. You have to have a brain filter going on.
Right.
So in any event, Pedrosa finished 11th.
Just barely 11th because Nicky was really getting his pace up. And if they had another 100 yards or something like that, he would have beaten Pedrosa.
Yeah, 3/10 was the final finishing thing exactly.
If you look at the lap times for the last, you know, 4 or 5 laps, Danny was in the 2 minute, and Nicky was in 1:58.
Right, right.
You know,
Nicky had a second half of the race, or maybe last third, if you want to say that.
Yeah, I think it was last third.
Was very impressive because he got off to a not very good start, didn't mm-hmm. qualify all that well, to put it mildly. And
we should actually mention the fact that he was riding with some pretty serious injuries. And I think that,
yes,
you get injured, and sometimes you can actually go a day without really feeling the pain of the injury. I think that a lot of people were saying, like, oh, lucky Nicky, now he gets an extra day of rest from the rain. I'm thinking, he's going to be hurting even more from that on his back. This bruise
right,
is going to be nasty,
up and,
you know.
And
he's going to be all stiffing,
sure.
All stiff and whatever, and those stitches in his chest. I mean, how did he get those? That sounds like he actually, you know, ripped it by stretching the skin in his chest. It's really nasty.
It doesn't sound good.
Sound good. So I'm sure that he was in pain and as usual, a warrior. So.
And what was real quick, the details on that crash? You saw the video.
Yeah. And so it was very strange because it was in between two corners. It wasn't like, I mean, he may have been slightly sideways from the previous right-hander and going to a left. But in general, it looked like he was straightened up and ready to take a right. And all of a sudden, he was just flying through the air, and the bike just spit him off. And then the bike just kept going straight. You know, it was one of those, like, classic, the bike knows better kind of moves, you know.
Now, but doesn't that show that the Ducati, to a point, what it will do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have to keep going back to what Nicky said the first time he rode the bike. He's like, they're not paying Stoner enough. This thing is just a wild beast, you know. So,
yeah.
But anyway, so I was very impressed to see that. I was really worried that he was going to finish outside the points, you know, and he actually put in a great show at the end. He was one of the fast. I think he had the fastest lap on the last lap.
I think they said something. Second to last lap. Taking a look at it real quick here.
He had the fastest time of all the riders on the last lap.
Which is of the whole race,
of the whole field, of the whole field at lap 22,
on that lap, yeah. 1:58 2:73 yeah. And he did a typical Nicky Hayden thing. He manned up, he goes out there, he does his job, you know, over and over again, 22 laps in a row. And hey, he picked up compared to his qualifying position, which he qualified 16th, which is disastrous.
Yeah.
And finished 12th, which is, you know, also not great. But hey, you know, it was one spot behind and 3/10 behind Danny Pedrosa, who I think if there's one guy that Nicky wants to spank, it's going to be Danny Pedrosa.
Oh, yeah. I think that maybe part of the motivation for him was that one of his guys probably said, hey, you know, let's put number 3 on the mm-hmm. lap board when he goes by, so that he knows that Danny's the next guy. And like,
right, right. You know he's not going to win this race, but hey, you could beat Pedrosa.
Yeah, but he was chasing down Gibernau.
Yeah,
who actually, you know, put on a pretty
decent. Let's talk about Gibernau in a second here.
Okay,
yeah,
so Gibernau was next.
Yes. In any event, and as far as Hayden's overall hopes for the season and everything.
He's not going to win a championship,
and
he's probably not even going to win any races. But you know, if he doesn't hurt himself, so my big worry is, you know, first race weekend he hurts himself. My big worry is that he's going to get injured a couple times this year. But if he doesn't, I think he's, you know, I still believe that he is a good match for this bike, and the, you know, we're going to see good results from that pairing in the future. Right. Not this year, but next year.
I certainly hope so. And that's kind of what I'm feeling through this way. So moving on, 13th in the finish, Seth Gibernau.
Yay.
We had the hair. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit shorter this year.
Yeah.
You know, but it still looks very sort of styled and nice. Sete and Valet have patched up their differences in an official, you know.
That was just weird.
Man love ceremony. But I don't know. What do you think of Sete's performance overall at Qatar?
It's pretty much what – I mean, he definitely exceeded my expectations. I expected him to be outside the points.
The guy qualified 15th. He finished 13th. This is his first race, and he was out. He was gone. He was nowhere for two seasons. He did nothing. He didn't go to World Supers or anything. He sat on the beach and drank mimosas or whatever it is they enjoy in Spain and sangria and did nothing for 2 years. And then he came back, and he qualifies 15th out of 18 riders and finishes 13th out of 17 riders that finished. And it's like, you know, Sete, you're the man.
Yeah, it's not bad.
And plus, how old is the guy? You know? So, yeah, so something like that. So I think Sete did all right.
It was great to see. Great to see him back. Although I have a lot of issues with his team, but, you know.
The thing is that's his team. I mean, I'm not
100%. The sponsors I'm talking about. I'm really, you know, not a big fan of the fact that he's being sponsored by one of the worst dictators in the world. I think he's listed as in the top 10 of the worst dictators by, I don't know, Newsweek or whatever.
We're watching a race that's sponsored by the Masters of Death. I mean, Marlboro is still a big sponsor in MotoGP. We can't start getting picky about where the money's coming from.
Okay. That's a good point. That's a good point. That's a good point. So then we have Melandri.
Right. Marco. So,
yeah.
On the Hayate that they kept saying, the Hayate, but it's really Kawasaki. I loved that all race long, you know, and pointing out too that this bike is not going to be developed anymore,
right,
and that it's not, you know, poor old Marco. And like we said, this is a MotoGP dead end after about halfway through. But he did a good job out there in the race this time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a real shame because he was actually doing fantastic on lap one. He passed a bunch of guys. He was ninth, I think. And then immediately ran off.
Yeah.
In the same spot.
That was a bummer to watch that.
In the same spot he ran off during qualifying. So that's a bummer.
But pushing too hard.
What's really amazing is that he passed two riders that didn't go off the track at all. And finished in front of them because both Takahashi and Kanepa never went off the track.
Right.
And, I mean, we didn't see him going off the track, but also if you look at the lap times, they never showed up.
No, they didn't have an off according to the statistics and stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, the stats aren't covering us exactly of who went off.
No, not who went off, but if you look at just lap times.
Right.
For every single lap, for every single rider. You can tell which ones they went off because it's like, you know, 2 minutes and 7 seconds or something like that because they had to get back on or whatever.
Right. But now, I'm a little surprised about that in Kanepa's case. Not so much in Takahashi, but a little bit with Kanepa because he was so promising in Indy last year, if you remember the testing and all that we did in Indy.
Yeah.
And just overall, Kanepa was like, wow, this guy is a stud. They need to bring him up to the A game. And he qualified last and he finished last for Kanepa. Now I'm jumping ahead here, but it was a little bit weird, but in any event, Sete finished 13th, Marco 14th, Yuki Takahashi finished 15th after qualifying 17th. So he picked up two spots, which one of those was Caparossi. I think that was still a admirable. You know, he picked up a point in his rookie MotoGP race.
Yeah, but you guys, you also have to say that, you know, Dovizioso picked up 11 points or 13 points in his first race in MotoGP. So on this, the same bike quote. Same
there you
team,
go.
Quote,
you,
quote.
You know, yeah. You're right. You got to kind of put a thing on it there, whatever that's called. But
a qualifier?
Something, you know. Toslin finished 16th, which Toslin had gone off track. I think he may have had some kind of damage going on with his bike.
Oh, really?
Something not necessarily full-on damage, but something that affected his riding. Because he actually came...
That's right. It was the sabotage unit from Colin Edwards out of the garage.
It was. Right. That was what it was, yes. Yep. No, when he came back out on, he was actually ahead of Melandri on the track and all of that. And he just sort of seemed to fade. And I haven't seen any news about it or reasons why or what happened. But how did Sete pick up two spots on him? And Toslin couldn't do it, you know. So maybe not full on damage, but you know something that you know his tires got scuffed up more.
I'll tell you what was damaged. It was his confidence.
Yeah, there you go. That's actually as much of a component as anything else. Yeah. So
because he was running 2 minutes and stuff like that, and I just don't see. I mean, what he had dust for that many laps on his tires? No way. So yeah, I think he lost his confidence. Maybe the settings of the bike. I mean, he was probably struggling right from the beginning, and well, I'm sure that there's a certain guy who finished in fourth place that was very happy to see that.
I was just gonna say, I'll bet you there's somebody that's like, you know, went home and slept really good that night, and had a big grin on his face and stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's still a little bit rearing its ugly head, the Toadsland Edwards soap opera battle.
Yeah.
And then Nicola Canepa finished dead last, 17th in the thing after qualifying 18th. A fairly uneventful race for him.
Yeah. And I'm surprised he did that poorly with two guys going off. He should have been in front of him.
Hey, he was up to 16th or so at some point. I Ooh. Mean, you know. I was a little surprised that he overall did so unremarkably after, you know, particularly after the testing efforts and all that we saw in Indy. You know, this guy's a stud. He might be able to manage the Ducati, et cetera, you know, and then he qualifies last and he finishes last. New track. I mean, you know, he's a rookie, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody's got to finish last. Somebody's got to be last.
He's also really young. I mean, he's like
barely 20. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, not holding it out that he's, you know, he's going to suck all season long. But still, I was a little bit surprised of how that one turned out.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer. I mean, to finish behind two guys that went off the track, I think, is...
brutal.
Relatively
brutal. Yeah, I agree. So, all right. So there's our race in Qatar. I mean, and honestly, it was about that. It was pretty much of a snoozer of a race. I mean, other than the Pedrosa and De Angelis incident and a few passes here and there.
We did have a good start. You know, we had Lorenzo and Rossi, you know, square off a little bit. And, you know, Colin came through the ranks.
Yes. It's MotoGP. I mean, it's worth watching no matter what, but... Was it the most exciting race this season? I certainly hope not. You know?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's just, and there's a variety of reasons for it. What did they get? Because, you know, they go out, they do their practice on Friday, they do the qualifying and whatnot on Saturday, warm up on Sunday. Race is delayed. So what happened on Monday? Have you seen that? Did they have another warm up?
They had warm up too. Yep.
Okay. So this is the second warm up. You know, but that's a short session, and it's, you know...
And it was owned by Stoner, and Rossi was second, and...
Right.
You know, nothing really changed. No
whatever. This race is a bit of an anomaly. Once we get to Europe, we're going to see... Things are going to shake out a little bit differently. Motegi is a bit of a question mark here in basically, well, 1 week from now or so, from when this podcast goes up. And not 100% sure what to expect from Motegi.
Let's cover the 250s really quick.
Let's talk about it, because that was a much better race.
There was some really cool stuff going on there.
Oh, it was awesome.
First of all, I have to say that Pacini wins. You know, we don't really give awards like Formula One blog does, but maybe we should start. And I think we should start with Pacini as the biggest freaking drama queen out there. Because I'm going back which race was it last year where Barbera was like the evil one?
Oh, dude.
I mean, which one of the three? The most evil one. It was where Simoncelli fell and got back on and finished eighth and whatever. Anyway, yeah, you know the race I'm talking about, but I forget where it was.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you in 250s, but I do recall vaguely what you're talking about. Yeah,
So in that race, you know, Barbera was blamed by Pacini for knocking him off, and he actually like showed up in the pit lane and was waiting for Barbera to go by.
I'm going to wait for you in the parking lot. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if you look at the replays of that thing, it was totally Pacini's fault. He was on his own, and he got maybe startled because some guy came up in front of him, and then he fell. And in this race, you know, he fell, I think, right in the very beginning. It was definitely on the first lap, but I think it was one of the first corners. And he immediately got up and just started just tossing dirt and not like, oh, I fucked up, but more like, I can't believe
one of these
rookies or whatever pushed me off. So anyway, so he definitely wins the drama award because that was completely his mistake. There was like, you look at that as like he fell.
Yeah.
What I found the most interesting, intriguing about this race was that a lot of the favorites were really far down in the pack. I mean, Bautista,
exactly.
Aoyama, Dimeglio,
yeah,
all these guys.
Let's start off right off the bat with who the hell is Kuzel?
Kuzel, I'm actually sort of familiar with this because of the Jules thing.
Seriously, you got a guy with no sponsor on his motorcycle. Was there any stickers on that motorcycle at all? and it's like, wow, this guy's actually in lead, you know?
Yeah, that was so cool.
It was great. It was the Cinderella story.
Scott earlier today, I don't think this is in an interview, but he said that he kept seeing that bike going around. He was like, did they get to a back marker that fast already?
Yeah, so it was like that. Yeah. And it was because it was awesome. It was, like I say, it was a Cinderella story.
Yeah, that was
wonderful. The other big story about Qatar for 250s was that Marco Simoncelli did not even qualify.
Well, he didn't get to start.
Right. No start. It wasn't out there. He didn't win the grid or anything because of the scaphoid.
Yeah, so that's bad news.
Yeah,
there was like this flurry of news just before that, like, he was coming, he wasn't coming, he was coming, he wasn't coming. I'm not even sure if he actually even bothered flying out.
I thought he was there, but okay, maybe not. Yeah. But anyway, in any event,
Hector Barbera did manage to eventually pass Kuzel and.
But it was tough.
It was a battle. Tough, and the guy just would not give up. It was so cool. It was so
like,
cool.
Where did this guy come from? Yeah.
I actually loved, you know, all those guys that I mentioned earlier, like Bautista, Ayama, and Dimeglio,
yeah,
were like, you know, running 12th or 11th or something like that. And just were looking, you know, like they were just struggling. They all came back. I mean, Dimeglio ended up on the podium. Hiroshi Oyama was fourth. Bautista was actually closing on the top two guys. He was closing on Kluzel. But
yes.
But then I think either tires. Well, this was a little earlier than the 11th lap, but yeah, he just kind of lost his rhythm or something like that and got passed by a bunch of guys. I think he got passed by like three guys in one corner.
Right.
And then he never really recovered.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
go ahead.
This race is such an anomaly. It's an exception to the rule.
Which part of it? The Qatar part?
Yeah, exactly. The Qatar part. No, the conditions. Everybody's going there on the tires that were, you know, projected to last 11 laps and a 13-lap race and you know, all sort of stuff. It was just like, this is a bit of a weird one. It really was. Just seeing Clouzel up there, like I said, a blank motorcycle, you know. I was like, wow, you know.
That's so cool. It is so cool.
Yeah. And if we can hope for racing action in the 250 series in their swan song of this is the last season of 250cc motorcycle racing that we'll see, and it's going to be like this, what a way to go out.
Oh, I totally agree. That's a great point. That is a great point.
Yeah.
Let's hope for more.
I do. I hope for more. Because it was better racing than we had in MotoGP. It was better racing than we had in World Superbike at Qatar. Just to watch these guys. There wasn't a whole lot of nasty, dirty, fairing, bashing fights.
Yeah. Actually, Hector Bubba was extremely well behaved.
Yeah. Exactly. It was, you know, nice, zippy, clean passes underneath, you know, the other guy and all of that sort of thing. But a fair amount of them. I think we had battles all the way down. You know, it wasn't just the top couple guys, you know, it seemed like there was battles going on all the way down. It was a good race. I enjoyed it a lot. When you said that it was amazing, you know, I watched it and I'm like, wow, you know, and I watched the speed telecast, which because it was only 13 laps, they could actually show the entire race.
God.
Yeah. You know, complete with commercials, which my God, there was a lot of them, but, they, you know, they'd come back and they'd been pretty much where they left off. And it was just, you know, it was good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yes, I liked. So Barbera, Clouzel, and Demeglio for the podium there in 250s. And Clouzel, you know, good job. Hoorah, dude. I think you did a great job. Don't count on being on the podium.
Let's not forget that Demeglio is a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, champion.
That's true. You're right.
125 Demeglio, champion.
Yeah, was in 125s last year. Yeah, yeah. Picked up a podium in his first 250 race.
Yeah, so big kudos to him. And yeah. He was way back. He had to really fight through to get that. So.
He did. Where did Demeglio qualify?
He qualified okay, but it's just that he got swallowed by the pack early on in the race.
Oh, yeah. He qualified third as well. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But yeah.
So he had to make that up because he was, I think, like 10th or 11th at one point.
Yeah. But no, it was a good race. I enjoyed watching it. It was, you know, fun stuff and everything. Aoyama finished fourth. Raffaele De Rosa finished fifth, Aoyama's teammate,
mm-hmm.
who is very much the teammate, you know, because that guy, he qualified 14th and managed to pick up fourth.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Wait,
Hiroshi qualified 14th?
Rossi?
No, Hiroshi.
Raffaele De Rosa.
Yeah, yeah, so he finished fifth. Sorry, because you said fourth.
Rossi wasn't in this race, Jules.
No, I said Hiroshi.
It's been a lot of years. But it was a good race to watch. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, I think at this point your only legal option is to go to MotoGP.com.
Yeah.
Which we've talked about that one a little bit. Of is MotoGP.com worth paying for and everything? I think it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Just,
it is.
I mean, a little bit, Jules and I are somewhat obligated.
They had this great, I'm being very sarcastic here, but they do have a lot of great interviews and whatever. I wasted 7 or 8 minutes watching that horrible interview that... What's his guy? What's the pit guy's name? Fred something? I don't know. George, whatever.
Yeah, George. George something.
That he got a like an exclusive MotoGP look at the Desmos Adichie. He got to talk to Stoner's main mechanic, and It was the most boring, useless 8 minutes I've spent on MotoGP.com in a long time.
Wow.
It's like, oh, man.
That's brutal.
Can you please tell me something interesting? Like, the question, he would be like, so, Stoner, does he change his settings from race to race? well, yes, he does. And then the camera, the camera's like hovering, and it's almost like there's somebody standing behind the camera guy, like, oh, you can't get too close to it because then you might give away some secrets, you know. So like, it would like zoom in, like, oh, they're talking about the swing arm, so it would zoom in on the swing arm, and then suddenly the camera would be pulling away. It's like, I got nothing out of that thing, but the fact that these guys have so much material, I mean, you could spend every day, and there's stuff there to watch, to listen to, and so I think, you know, and you can't watch those videos without paying for the subscription, so it's not just right. Like a cynical, like, or we have to do this because, you know, we're fans or something like that. It really is worth it. It's totally
it is.
Worth it.
It's it
the
is
best
worth it.
Value, like, out of any sports package, if you think about, like, how much people pay for freaking, you know, football
NASCAR.
And all that kind of stuff. Or NASCAR, Jesus Christ. I mean, like, 50, they pay that much per race, you know?
Yeah. And, I mean, what was it? I was bitching about this a race or two, a show or two ago, with $60 or whatever it was in American dollars.
Yeah.
And, hey, I'll be able to screw around with this for 8 months.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's like, you know, it's all right.
Yeah.
And they did, they've tweaked and tuned the website a little bit. Like I said, there is a link now that I have found, and I'm going to use this link where I can go to and find the race without having a lot of spoilers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I sort of have to, you know, unfocus my eyes and hold my hand over the screen and all that a little bit, but it's not too bad. And some of their, like you were saying, the features and stuff are, some of them are good, some are lame. You know, hey.
Well, they're very, you just have to remember that this is the official Dorna website. So they're never going to say anything that's going to be, you know, they're not going to have Colin Edwards saying, you know, that James Tolson is a little
a big
bitch,
tool.
You know?
yeah, exactly. And until MotoGPOD can support Jules and I flying out to every race and doing the non-politically correct video version, which is going to cost you a lot more than $60 a year, yeah. You know, then I think that it's a good value. And like you said, it did look good. It looked good on the big screen.
Yep.
So yeah, you know, what the hell? I'm happy that I subscribed again. So.
Okay. So that's pretty much all we had, right? Motegi's coming up. We're going to talk about something else next week. I think we're going to talk about Moto2 next week.
Yeah,
so
are we going to talk about Moto2? We also have World Super Dupers.
Well, World Super Dupers and Motegi preview, definitely.
And Formula 1. Got to throw some of that in there. I don't even know where they're going this weekend, but okay. But it's always entertaining. And yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. And then we got Motegi coming up, not this weekend, but the following weekend, which is what, the 25th, 26th. Of April will be Motegi.
For a lot of people in America, it's going to be on a Saturday. We're going to be watching the race.
If you want to watch it live, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. I haven't checked the speed schedule. Don't know when that'll be. We'll talk about the next race of Speed TV. But, you know, it'll be the usual thing, and you got to check your local listings and all that good stuff. But other than that, whatever. MotoGP season has started. I am very excited. Even though we had a little bit of a snoozer as far as MotoGP racing is concerned, it was MotoGP. There was drama. There was you know.
And let's face it was not as bad as Valencia at the end of last season. So.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. It was better than that. Yeah, it was. It was kind of cool. So whatever. Looking forward to Motegi. We will definitely talk about that one again. And hey. We'll talk to you again later soon, Jules.
All right, man. Cool. Ciao.
And there we go. That's the call with Jules completed. Told you it was a long one, but did have a lot to talk about, what with the opening round of 2009 and all of that. And I thought it was kind of interesting stuff. Like we said in the call, we got Motegi coming up. The date on that actual race is going to be April 26th. Now, that's in Japan, so not 100% sure right off the top of my head exactly when that will be for time-wise, if you're going to watch it live on MotoGP.com. So check out the MotoGP.com website and timeanddate.com and those kind of places to figure out exactly what time you should be watching live MotoGP racing. That same weekend, we have World Super Dupers in Assen. So World Superbike has got some conflicting dates with MotoGP this year. They're kind of jumping back and forth from a sort of a every other weekend to every now and then the weekends line up, and it sort of seems to level out in like June, I think. But until then, it seems like there's a couple race weekends where it all overlaps, and that kind of makes for a big weekend when you have got, you know, World Supers and MotoGP, and if you want to watch it all together and all of that, you kind of stuck in front of the TV, which in the middle of summer is not always the funnest thing, but whatever. AMA, unfortunately, I don't even have the information about. I'm so upset with the whole thing. It's just such a mess. The speed coverage is a joke. I think the racing is proving to be is somewhat of a disaster just from what I'm seeing. It's a shame. But, well, hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about AMA and kind of see what's going on. But needless to say, I think this series is in a bit of disarray. So that's going to do it for today's show. And we will talk to you again next week. Enjoy the nice weather if it's coming your way. We've got spring going on here in Oregon, so you just never know what's going to happen. It could be snowing in the morning and beautiful sun in the afternoon. But I'm enjoying it because I like this time of year a lot, and I'm going to be getting ready to go out and ride. So if you're doing that, stay safe, keep the rubber side down, and we'll talk again next week. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.